From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made with the School Project. Students at School Without Walls wanted to talk about some difficult subjects. Fear, hostility, division, and hate that they had experienced. In addition to the open dialogue that they facilitated, they created art and writing components, which were collected in a book for print. The project was part of the Gundy Institute's Youth Healing Hate Grants, where local youths age 12 to 24 can receive up to $1,000 for projects that provide a creative solution to fear, hostility, and division within their community and address the root causes of hate. This hour, we'll hear from two winners of the most recent round of awards, and it comes at a time where the Rochester community is struggling with an increase in violence. Most recently, a 16-year-old East High School student was killed. Nationally, according to NPR, there were 7,759 reported hate crimes in the United States in the year 2020. That's the most in more than 12 years. I'd like to welcome our guests now. Erin Thompson is co-executive director of the M.K. Gundy Institute for Nonviolence. Erin, thank you for being with us.
My true pleasure to be a part of this, Evan. Thank you.
Jorge Jimenez is with us, a Youth Healing Hate Grant winner. Jorge, thank you for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
And Isaiah Santiago, also a Youth Healing Hate Grant winner. Hi, Isaiah. Thanks for being with us.
Hello. I'm glad to be on.
Erin, let me start with you as co-executive director of the M.K. Gundy Institute for Nonviolence. What is, what's your assessment of how things are in our community right now?
Well, you know, in some respects, things are in a bad way. Things are, you know, the situation's bleak in some ways. And at the same time, there are a lot of efforts underway, and there have been for some time, to turn the tide and to change the way we relate to one another to ultimately decrease the amount of violence happening. So it's somewhere, you know, there's good and bad going on, Evan, and we're focusing on what we can do to try and impact and move the needle toward the good.
Well, what are the Youth Healing Hate Grants exactly, Erin?
So these are a series of grants. We've had this initiative in place since 2017, so we're in our fifth year. And what we essentially do, I'll give a little backstory on how it came to pass, if that's fine.
Absolutely.
All right, fantastic. So a lot of what the Institute gets up to is enabling people to see the not enabling them, but kind of turning on their sensibilities to seeing the humanity in one another, to not other folks, to recognize that our interests are bound up in the welfare of one another. And so to that end, we have been holding a series, variety of different types of workshops, but one in particular was called Let's Talk About Hate. And this is a series that has been going on since 2016, and it basically gathers people to examine exactly what hate means, how it shows up in their lives, and one of the activities as part of this this group gathered was to imagine if a $5,000 check were to come their way with the focus of reducing hatred, brainstorm ideas for how they would actually implement those activities. And so this was a group of older folks. This was adults that were meeting. But the innovation and the creativity expressed during that group gathering in 2017 led to us thinking about involving young folks. And so 2017 saw the birth of the Youth Healing Hate Project. We had support from Farish Foundation that year. And we started off by providing 10 grants, $1,000 each, for young people to create solutions to hate, whether it be in their school, in their community, in their faith group. And so that's essentially carried over year over year. And we basically look for young folks to engage one another and the community, expressing themselves in ways that make sense to them and that are going to draw the attention of other young people. So this is often in artistic ways, through dialogue and such. And it's creating a way for the youth to have a voice in this ongoing conversation about kind of the issue that you raised at the top of this discussion about how are we doing as a society, and to address some of the challenges that they see to us becoming this beloved community that Martin Luther King dreamed.
Well, we're going to talk to Isaiah and Jorge about their thoughts and what they've been doing. But one other point I want to touch on with you, Aaron, is in this moment where, for example, gun violence. So we've been talking to people like Justin Morris, people in our community who work on trying to reduce violence, trying to understand why kids join gangs, where do kids go to find community, how do kids deal with trauma. And one of the points that Justin was making in a recent conversation was kids, if they decide, often boys and young men, but not always, but if they decide they want a gun, they can probably get it, legally or not. And if they decide that that's the only way that they are going to feel safe, and there are people telling them that that's what they need to feel safe, they may arm themselves. That we've got more people walking around armed because they feel like that's what it takes to be safe. They feel like in this world, you've got to be able to punch back or shoot back. And as someone who is leading an Institute for Nonviolence, that has to be heartbreaking. But how do you grapple with that sort of psychological need that someone feels like, I have to belong somewhere, I have to belong to a community that will make me safe, and if there's violence that is going to be visited upon me, I may have to meet it with violence? What do you do with that, Aaron?
It's heartbreaking and it's understandable, Evan. And so, you know, a lot of the challenge, I think, for the older folks, for the adults, for the elders in this community, for all of us really, is to kind of break through the sense of isolation that a lot of us can feel, especially our young folks these days. With so much of communicating going on online, and kind of with the tendency for hyperbole to creep into our online communications and online bullying to play a part in violence taking place, whether it's self-harm or, you know, interpersonal harm. Absolutely. You know, building community is at the base of the Institute's efforts generally, and certainly in the Youth Healing Hate Project. And so this is, it's an aim to get young people coming together, recognizing that there are welcoming communities, not only of young folks, but also of adults. And we can talk a little bit about some of the particular projects that address that. And to, you know, realize that carrying a gun, arming oneself, isn't the only alternative out there. And so yeah, that kind of goes to the heart of what this Youth Healing Hate Project is about, Evan.
So Isaiah Santiago, let me start with you. And I know that when you were 16, you suffered some serious loss in your life, and I want to give you some space to talk about it and talk about your project.
Yeah, definitely. When I was 16, I lost my friend, LaShawn Curry, to gun violence. I also lost my uncle. He was in New York City asleep on the train when he was killed. And later down the road, I also lost my middle school friend. He was 15-year-old when he was killed, Jameer Wade. And around this time of me losing my friends and, of course, you know, being sad off of, you know, losing these people, I questioned exactly how can I help, you know, as a young person in the community. How can I help to make sure and to help other young people that's around my age group? And around that time, I wrote like a 5-page plan on how to combat youth gun violence, and combating it by focusing on the young people who's a part of the gangs, who are a part of the violence. I figured out that a good answer to that is focusing on the passion of the young people, focusing on what they love to do. When we see violence, a lot of people say we got to get some jobs. But the truth is, they're making money. They're making money on the streets. They're making money selling drugs. So us giving them a job, having to ride the bus in December, you know, when it's cold outside, going to Taco Bell to work, isn't really the answer, but focusing on the passion of what they already love to do is really something that we could positively replace with the negative that they have in their life. So when, with me knowing this, I started the program, I was able to partner with the city, and as time, the city's Department of Recreation and Health, and as time went along, I also partnered, I'm currently partnering with the Monroe County Probation Office. They're just sending young people my way to really get that youth-to-youth mentorship, because nobody understands us like us. When we look at gun violence, when we look at the issues that we're facing as young people, nobody understands us besides us around the same age, around the same influences and the same social media. So how exactly can I mentor and kind of show the way that I've transferred from, you know, going down the negative path of life to the positive path, and also showing them that you can do it too?
So what's the plan for the future here? How are you going to continue to do what you want to do to have a positive effect on people who've been through so much, and people like yourself, Isaiah?
Luckily, when we look at Rochester, it's very easy to get involved. It's very easy to get involved with making effective change. And of course, I'll continue working through my organization, We Got This, to combat youth gun violence. I'll continue, you know, fighting the stigma against mental health and mental illness, which is a part of the problem as we look at gun violence. But also, I would love, as time goes along, to focus on policies. Right now, we are experiencing old policies dealing with new issues that's not making any type of change. So if, as a young person, as I go along through the years, how can I get involved in policies and actually make innovative policies to really change the community? So as time goes along, I definitely plan to get into seats where I can definitely make effective change on the government level and also on the grassroots level.
Well, and that's, first of all, young people having to think about how policy affects violence and community health, is that's heavy. That's a lot. I mean, policy is, you know, sort of hard to parse for most of us in life, let alone people who are going through so much at a young age. And one of the things that we talked about with Justin Morris recently was the importance of having representatives who are credible. So in every part of our city that where people are hurting, to have representatives who are credible, who can reach out and be heard and be listened to. And I know it matters
Absolutely.
To you. Isaiah, you're someone who's, I know you've been thinking about that, thinking about people who have felt the lure of gangs, have felt the lure of that kind of feeling of community. What pulls people in that direction, and how do you pull people away from that?
Well, we have to focus on the issue at hand. Sometimes we focus on, you know, everything else around it, but the truth is we have to focus on the root issues, and then we go around that, and we deal with it one by one. And one of the root issues is the stigma against mental health and the ignorance in our community with mental health. Mental health is really a root cause as we look at, you know, gun violence, and we look at, you know, different gangs and drug violence and everything around that. Because if you have a young person who is upset or who is mad, and you have a community or a group outside of their house saying that this is the way to deal with it, then of course they're going to take it. So if we really help the young people understand mental health and understand this is why you feel this way, we see right now is a lot of young people are in a place of frustration. They're frustrated because they don't know why they're so upset. They don't know why they're so depressed, why they have so much fear, and they don't know how to deal with it. So if we take a pause and focus on how do we help our young people understand feelings? How do we help our young people understand emotions? How do we help our young people understand why do they feel this way? Why do they feel like they have to have a gun to be safe? Why do they feel like they have to be out and this group of people in order to be validated? It's also a popular thing right now, right? This is popularity. This is something that if I have a gun, I'm cool, right? So there's so much stuff that goes to this equation when it comes to the equation of gun violence and solving it. We have mental illness that's a part of the problem. We have popularity that's a part of the problem. And then we also have families not letting their children know, letting their son or their daughter know that it's okay to be who you are and you're perfect the way that you are. If there's not a family or a structure behind a young person to let them know that it's okay to be who you are and exactly how you are, and you don't need a gun to be cool. Or you don't need to be in a gang to be cool. A lot of the problems that we're facing won't be here. Because if a young person don't know who they are from the structure not telling them who they are, then it's so easy to understand what society wants you to be. And we focus on that with African-American children. It's easy if you don't know who you are to accept that you're a criminal, because every morning you have to go through a metal detector in order to even get into your school to learn. It's easy to accept that because you live in this neighborhood, you have to be a part of this gang to be accepted. So there's so many problems in this equation that we have to focus on in order to really combat gun violence, and we have to move fast. We are numb. We are tired. We are sad. Every day seeing another person killed, a 16-year-old killed. I walked the stage to graduate last month from School of the Arts, and now I'm going to St. John Fisher for college. And as I walked past that stage, I thought how many young people are missing out on walking past the stage because their life was taken. We have to move fast. We have to move fast, and we have to move in a way of innovating the ways that we deal with the new issues that we're facing.
Isaiah, what's the reality? How easy is it to get a gun if people want to get one?
It's really easy. I mean, like, the guns are out there. It is extremely easy. All you have to do is find the right group, and you can get a gun just like that. I have a couple people, young people that I worked with, and they could just get a gun today if they wanted to. It's easy, and definitely the illegal way. It's really easy the illegal way.
The feeling of what makes someone safe or perceive that they are safe is different for all of us. And it's like I was saying to Aaron, I mean, I understand, that's never been my experience, but I can understand people saying, this is, I need to be armed to feel safe, that it's dangerous, that I, you know, this is what I have to do. Isaiah, for you, if you're around a gun or guns, do you feel safer?
I don't think if it's in the right hands. It has to be in the right hands with the responsible people. If I'm around a police officer, let's say like Moses Robinson, right, that I know that has a gun to protect me, then of course I'll feel safe. But if I have somebody who didn't go through the legal process of getting a gun or just has a gun just to have it, you know, at that moment I wouldn't feel safe, because the only reason why you have this gun is because there must be something in your environment that you feel like you have to protect yourself from. So it's definitely a problem that has to be focused on.
Yeah. And finally, I want to, before we talk to Jorge about some of his work, Isaiah, I want to ask you, generally speaking, you know, you're growing up, when you were in, whether it's elementary school and middle school and high school, you are someone who is going to Fisher. You walked across that stage. You graduated. Did you always know that was going to be your future, Isaiah?
No, absolutely not. If some of my middle school teachers or some of my high school teachers heard me on this phone call right now, they'll probably hang up. I was terrible. And I really transitioned, you know, from being that bad kid. I was in middle school, I was getting into drugs. In middle school, I was getting into, surprisingly, in middle school, I was getting into gangs. Because that was my way of dealing with the hurt that I was going through. I was a hurt person, you know, dealing with my hurt through these actions. So I didn't always know that I would be going to St. John Fisher on a full ride, on a $104,000 scholarship. Because honestly, in middle school and in high school, I wasn't the student that you would even think is going to college at all. I'm pretty sure a lot of people thought that my next steps were jail. I wasn't really a good child, but I kind of transitioned as life has went along. I use that same process that I went through from that Isaiah to the Isaiah that I am now to really mentor other young people.
How did you do it? I mean, was it one day or was it gradual?
Oh, no, it was definitely gradual. It really came with me understanding that the reason why I was doing what I was doing was because I was hurt. That was my way of dealing with my hurt. And when I finally figured that out and figured out that I have to get my life together, that's really when everything changed.
How were your grades in middle school?
Straight F's. straight F's.
I mean,
yeah, straight F's.
Okay. You probably were in danger of not finishing school if you stayed on that course, right?
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. It was at the end of middle school to high school where I kind of changed just a little bit. And then gradually as my high school experience continued.
How did you teach yourself to become, or how did you get the kind of help you needed to become a better student?
It's really learning yourself. You know, when you go through things, it teaches you wisdom that you probably shouldn't have at 12 years old or 13 years old. And really, like, through my experiences, really where I learned everything. On top of that, I'm the oldest of five siblings. So I knew that I had five people following me that I had to represent for. And I really, like, took on the responsibilities that I had to take on.
What's the age of your siblings? Like, what's the age range?
So I was the only child for 8 years. Mm-hmm. I was the only child for 8 years, and then five children just showed up. I don't know where they came from. They showed up. So I have my oldest, youngest sibling is 10, and the youngest is 6.
How are they doing? I mean, are they learning from your example? Are they proud of you?
They definitely are, and it always touches my heart when one of my siblings come to a speaking engagement that I'm speaking at, or I was just in Albany last month speaking at the New York State Office of Mental Health System of Care Summit. And my siblings were there, and it's always great afterhand when they run up after I get off the stage and they hug me. And I have one of my sisters who tells me all the time, when I grow up, I want to be like my brother. And it really does touch me, and it encourages me to continue doing what I'm doing.
Well, we just got a message from Annie in Rochester who says, I'm just blown away by this young man. What an amazing person. People are hearing your voice. It's not just your siblings who are going to look up to you. And I'm curious to know how you see your own future now. What does adulthood look like? What are your dreams now, Isaiah?
My dreams is to do what I've been put on this earth to do, and that is to make effective change, and that is to make sure that my community is in a positive sense, and that I leave my mark on this world. And however I have to do that is how I will. I definitely plan to run for some office someday that I'll be effective in. I definitely plan to figure out wherever I can be effective and making effective change.
When is the first time that you really felt like when you thought of your own future, it was positive like this? What you just described is full of vision, confidence, and positivity. And I'm wondering if it was recently that it took that turn, or if it was, you know, earlier in high school. Can you remember?
Surprisingly, even when I was a bad kid in middle school, I had a vision of becoming a great person. I just didn't know how to become the person that I envisioned of becoming.
Mm-hmm.
But literally in middle school, I knew that I was going to be somewhere. And around middle school is when I got into acting. So I really got to, you know, this is why I talk about passion and how passion really switches a young person. I got into acting, and then they put me in front of my first audience to do public speaking. And I figured out that I loved doing that, but I couldn't do that while also doing the wrong things in school. So, like, I kind of had to even both of them out. So really, I knew as I, like, started acting in community theater and I started doing public speaking around middle school, that I was going to do my best and wherever I'm at to actually become and actually leave my mark wherever I'm at. I mean, it was around middle school for me.
Awesome. And I'm sorry I've hung on your story for so long, Isaiah, but boy, you're an amazing, you are one amazing person, man.
Thank you.
If I were to ask you, who loves you the most? Who are you tightest with in your life? What's the answer?
I would say the community. The entire community has took me on like their son. I call myself the community son. I know that I have support all throughout the community that's pushing me to go to the greatness that I can go to. So I have uncles that weren't my uncles when I was a kid. I have parents that I consider parents now that wasn't my parents when I was born, that I know that are pushing me and that believes in me. So it's really the community that I feel the love from. Every time that I'm on a news interview or I'm speaking somewhere, I know that I have a community behind me, pushing me. to be the greatest person I can become.
Isaiah Santiago is one of the Youth Healing Hate grant winners as part of the recent program, and we've been talking to him. We're going to talk to Jorge Jimenez in a second. We've been talking to Aaron Thompson, the co-executive director of the M.K. Gandhi Institute for Nonviolence, on some of the subjects that Isaiah just mentioned. I want to grab a phone call from Shirley in Rochester. Shirley Thompson back on the line with us. Hi, Shirley. Go ahead. Are you there, Shirley?
Oh, yes, I am. Can you hear me all right?
Yeah, just listen through your phone if you could. Go ahead, Shirley.
Okay, I just wanted to comment on Isaiah's remarks about getting to the root of the problems, and he was talking about mental health, and he talked about working on policies. And I just want, first of all, I want to commend you. I haven't even heard Jorge yet, but I want to commend you, Isaiah, for what you're doing with your life. And I wanted to offer that in looking at policy, I think it's important to look at the reasons why people, many people, experience mental health challenges. And so when we talk about policy, I think we have to look at the legal system, how that plays into people's mental health, the housing that people struggle with. I'm attending the task force meetings on recommendations around housing in the city of Rochester. So people struggle mightily with housing. We need to look at the policing that plays into mental health issues. We have to look at the health system. And we look, I think, also looking at the segregated schools with the resources that are lacking in many of the schools. So when you talk about the structures that feed into the root of problems, I trust that you're talking about looking at policies in regards to those areas. And when you talk about safety and people who have guns and who you feel safe with, officers such as wonderful officers like Moses Robinson, I feel safe in a heartbeat around him with a gun. I wouldn't necessarily feel safe around all officers with guns. So I think we have to also look at implicit bias that plays out in our community, particularly with people who have guns who are supposed to protect us. Thanks very much for taking my call.
Shirley, thank you. Yeah. Isaiah, you want to respond there?
Yeah, absolutely, and I agree. And that's why I said Moses Robinson, because I know that he is somebody that we all can trust. And, of course, all officers, you know, aren't safe officers, but also all officers aren't bad officers. And absolutely, as far as when we look at policies, we look at, of course, the legal structures, and we look at how poverty, you know, affects the mental health. When I was creating, I created a class for my senior year, a mental health literacy class, for the school district, RCSD. I started creating the class, and it's almost done, and it's looking good for the class to be in all of the high schools, either by the upcoming school year or the next school year after that. But while making this class, I really tried to focus on all the details on the effects of the environment of a young person. How can it affect their mental health, and how do we identify? How do we identify what's actually affecting the mental health of young people? So I absolutely agree that there's so many entities that really contributes to mental illness and really the status of where we're at right now in our community.
Aaron Thompson, do you want to also weigh in on what you heard from Shirley?
Well, sure. Thank you, Evan. So, you know, one point really stands out. She mentioned that not all folks necessarily feel safe around police, or that the police are a resource that increases safety. And, you know, that fractured relationship between our police and communities of color is a major factor in the chaos that we see playing out in our communities. And so several of the Youth Healing Hate projects that we've supported relate directly to that relationship. And so we're talking about, you know, talking circles involving young folks and police, collaboratively coming up with murals in the community involving police and young folks. And, you know, through as many different angles as possible, we're going to keep resurfacing the very tenuous relationship between police and people of color, because that's kind of central to our community really being a true community.
Shirley, thank you very much, and so much more to talk about. We're going to talk to Jorge Jimenez a Youth Healing Hate grant winner alongside Isaiah Santiago. And we're going to take our only break of the hour. We'll come right back with them next right here on Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Friday on the next Connections, would you be a farmer? Is that a future you would want? And if the answer is no, why is that? This country is losing its farmers. Generation to generation, it's harder to keep farms going. And there is a movement afoot to change that. And you'll hear all about it Friday. This is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. There were a number of Youth Healing Hate grant winners. You heard Isaiah's story. I want to ask Jorge Jimenez to tell his story and his project. Jorge, the floor is yours.
Hi, Evan. First of all, I just want to say, Isaiah, you're such a great person. I used to work with you, and the way that you like to help people and encourage young folks to just be themselves and be who they want to be, and it's just incredible. For me, I did a couple projects, and not just myself, but some other folks from my school, Northeast College Prep. We were first trying to figure out what could we do to, you know, help these students who are struggling in class, who want to skip, who doesn't want to come to school, who are constantly in fights, who are doing drugs and all this. So we just kind of brainstormed a bit, and so we first did a little. So we have a huge part behind our school that we just created, like an outdoor classroom. Like, I know some folks just want to get out there, get some fresh air, and you know, do what they're going to do, but outside of the four walls of our school. So we did that, and it was such a great success. We have, we usually have just like parties and some stuff that we do back there. We also created some murals in the bathrooms with the encouraging words and quotes and images that, you know, because the bathroom is a place where you just want to go in and take a deep breath and just concentrate on what you're going to do when you get out, and just take a moment for yourself. So we decided to do that. So just people to look at and remind themselves, hey, I'm here to learn. I'm here to get a future. I'm here to become who I want to be when I graduate. So we did that. I also created a podcast with my English teacher, Paretta Baker. Shout out to her. She's such a nice person. So we created this podcast with different students who wanted to talk about problems in the school and what problems are they having, and you know, current issues going on in the community. So we did that, and we have our own channel on Spotify. We already have 3 episodes of the podcast. Is called Roar. It's an incredible thing. It was such, like, the process was just incredible, and trying to find people who wanted to get out of the comfort zone and speak up about what they are, problems that they're facing, and having the letting them trust us to hear them out was such, like, so incredible. And I didn't do it by myself. I also had my social worker, Jessica Nordquist, who encouraged me every time, every day. She was in my behind saying, oh, hey, you got to get this done, and hey, you need help. And she takes me out sometimes to, you know, to get some ideas of what we want to do. And her and Preta Baker, they're just been so incredible to help me out, and get some ideas for anything. Basically, they're there to support me. They are there to help me get through if I have any issues, and they've just been so nice to me.
So, Jorge, you're talking at the end there about people who show you love and make you feel good about yourself. How would you describe the people who are, you know, engaging in violence and getting caught up in some of the things we've been talking about? I mean, Isaiah talked about himself earlier this hour and said that, you know, when he was on a kind of a wrong track, that he had to kind of take a step back and realize that he was hurting. Do you think that's most people who are engaged in, whether it's violence, other activities, that they're going to look back and wish they hadn't? But, I mean, do you think they're hurting?
Oh, totally, yeah. That's one of the paths that, like, some kids just take their mind off of what they're struggling with, kind of just block it off. And they also kind of do it, just like Isaiah said, because it's popular, because it's a thing that everybody's doing. But yeah, totally. They're definitely hurting.
What do you think pulls people away from that most effectively?
Some other outside help, or like counseling, and getting people to talk to them and counsel them about, hey, this is not right. You know, let's try something else. Let's just go out of your comfort zone and let's try something new. So, like, someone that's there for them will definitely help them get out of that place where they're at right now.
And how do you see your own future right now?
Well, since I was little, I've always wanted to help people. It's in my family. We all help people some way or the other. So I see my future just like I'm currently working in a hospital. So I just want to keep staying here and getting my education for cardiothoracic surgery. I want to help people, not only in the medical way, but I also want to go out in the community and give out to people.
Boy, you've got a big future planned, Jorge. you're going to be taking care of a lot of people in the future. And there is something that stands out to me that I find really interesting that I want to ask both Jorge and Isaiah about. And that's the subject of helping people. And dovetailed with the fact that right now in our city, you know, people like Jorge and Isaiah will tell you that Moses Robinson, there's police officers like Moses Robinson that they can name. There are officers they can call out by name and say, this officer cares. This officer loves his community. This officer is someone we can trust. But it's the part of the reason that they can do that by name is there's also a concern that the average officer, they don't know if they can trust or feel good about. They don't know if that is a positive relationship. And what I don't hear, Jorge, I don't hear people like you who want to serve their community also saying, I want to be a police officer. And we hear the police department saying all the time, we have a hard time recruiting people. We have a hard time recruiting young people, people of color, people who come from not just sort of suburban backgrounds. And so I'm curious to know how you see police work generally and what it would take so that if young people think, I want to help my community in the future, on that list might be police work.
I mean, being a police officer is not, I wouldn't say it's a safe job. How can I say this? It's a very important job, and you risk your life. You are out there. You don't know what's going to come. You don't know how people are going to react. Everybody's now is like, oh, all the police officers they're evil, and they're, we can put the racism in there. And so like a way that we can like get people to, you know, get into that, I want to be a police officer, but I'm scared to do it because all the stuff that's going on in the community. We just need to make how can I say this? People are not knowing all the other stuff that's gonna affect you when you become a police officer. Like, there's such great people still out there. Not all is all criminals and people who are trying to own guns and do all these kind of all these things, bad things that everybody's doing right now. But becoming a police officer, I think I used to want to be a police officer when I was little, but I kind of deviated from that path because I got into medicine and got into trying to learn how to do help people, but in a different way. Just because I saw that all these people were getting killed, and I was kind of just got scared. And I feel like it's the same way with other people who want to become police officers, but we got to stop, think, and say, hey, it's not that bad. They're just there to help us to maintain balance so that it doesn't, everything just goes chaos. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah. So, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. Isaiah, what about you? What will it take so that policing is viewed as a positive thing that young people would say, if I want to help people, that's one of the things I could do?
Yeah, I think that it's beyond that. We have to first focus on the trust between adults and young people. We have to first start off right there. When we look at the community, there's a lot of problems right now. And part of the problems is the disconnect between the young generation and the older generation. Because the truth is you have young people who has the answers for older people, and you have older people who have the answers for young people. But because there's no trust in between these two generations, right now we're at a place of you know, confusion. Right now what we have to focus on doing is building this bridge between these two communities that's totally separated. Because, again, we have the answers for each other. And once we really focus on bringing back that trust between adults and children and young people, that's really when we'll see, you know, that's really when we can attack the problem of the stigma against police or the stigma against, you know, any other profession. So right now we have to focus on combating the trust that's disconnected between generations.
Okay. Aaron Thompson, you want to weigh in on that one too?
I'd love to. So, you know, Evan, police have to be seen as servants of the community. There has to be trust between the communities that they serve, and I'll emphasize the word serve. You know, they need to be seen as servants of the community, not as an occupying force, not as the, not as enforcers of property law and such. And then, you know, I'd say that police are not a viable substitute for neighbors feeling that they're in community with one another, for there being actually, you know, relationships between folks who are living proximate to one another. No outside elements are going to replace people actually communicating, getting to know and caring for one another. And so, you know, we're actively working as a community to reform what it means to be a police officer. You know, that's something that's actively being looked at, and we're also, you know, working on constructive programming to build the sense of community that in the communities themselves, and really to decenter the police response in situations where there's problems in the community, looking to empower folks to be able to increasingly take on some of these issues themselves, to build up the tools so that they can communicate with one another nonviolently and effectively. So.
Well, I'll say again, note to self, I want to try to sit down with Moses Robinson sometime and learn more about his approach. But I also, I want to highlight something one of our listeners just sent to me. And it may be sort of dovetailing with something Isaiah said. Isaiah described his own, some of his own childhood, his time in middle school, and said one of the phrases he used, you know, when I was kind of being a bad kid. Now, Isaiah is tough on himself. He thinks about, you know, where he was then compared to where he is now. And certainly I'm not here to nitpick that phrase. I mean, we're all tough on ourselves in some ways. But that's very different than what we heard, for example, from police in this community recently describing some of their work. And I was not comfortable with some of the ways that officers described their work. I said on this program, I don't mean to be Pollyanna, but I don't like hearing people say, our job is to catch the bad guys. I actually think that phraseology attaches something permanent. And Andy sends me a note. Andy says, Evan, I heard a great quote on a recent podcast that seems relevant. It was this: there are two types of people in this world, good people and good people in pain. We all need to do whatever we can to support and love our community. Andy, I love that. And even when my own son would play games, I didn't like the whole good guys, bad guys. Again, I don't mean to be Pollyanna, but Aaron Thompson, I wonder how you feel about that. When we start affixing terms like a bad guy, is there a danger to what that sort of inflicts?
Sure, yeah. You know, our words hold power. It, I think, shrinks down and minimizes the object of that assessment into that very simplistic term as bad guy, and then he's branded, and that's kind of the starting point for any other considerations about that person. You know, if we subscribe to the idea that people's actions are based on them looking to fulfill needs that we all have, there are universal needs that every human being on this earth has, and our circumstances differ, and so we take different routes to achieve, to gain, you know, to satisfy those needs. That goes a long way toward explaining some of the persistent issues that we have around certain types of crime and such. And so, you know, that's part of the aim of the conversations that we look to invite the community to, is to kind of peel back the layers of some of this language that we're using and get at the heart of the matter, which oftentimes points directly at relationships.
Yeah. Well, in our last few minutes here, I want to have Aaron just briefly mention, we don't possibly have time to go over every project that was submitted, and the Youth Healing Hate program has sparked a lot of really interesting ideas. You want to just mention a couple that stand out to you as well here, Aaron?
Sure, yeah. So there have been 38 projects over the last 5 years, all of them truly just incredible. And, you know, Jorge and Isaiah, you two are incredible spokespersons for yourselves and for your projects, and it's been wonderful working with you on the Institute side. Folks can go to, Evan, actually just kind of, folks can do a little bit of their own looking if they like. Rock Nonviolence is our handle on Instagram and on Facebook. And there are little write-ups about some of the other projects that have taken place. But you know, we've had everything from, community gardens being implemented. I mentioned earlier, you know, a sit-down between young folks and police. There was a talent show, a slam poetry and talent show event that brought together police and young people to have some fun, and then to sit down and discuss some of the challenges that the police are having in the local community. Project Awareness. I'm not going to actually do justice to all of the different projects that we've had, Evan, I'd really recommend Rock Nonviolence for folks, and they kind of speak for themselves.
Absolutely. Aaron, 30 seconds. What gives you hope most these days? And again, not to be sort of saccharine or sugary, but I want to finish in a way that says our community has amazing people doing amazing things, and I want to give you a little bit of time. 30 seconds. Tell me what gives you hope right now.
Oh, yeah. Well, people keep showing up for gatherings that we hold at the Institute, where the purpose is to get people together, cross sections of the community, people whose typical life patterns might not bring them in touch with one another, and get them talking. People keep showing up, and good things inevitably come out of those situations. But if we look at our features for this last hour, Evan, that's what really gives me the most hope. And for my post, I get to see the work that we're doing with young people ages 12 to 24. They are the future, and we're really in good hands if we allow them, give them platforms to express themselves, continue to encourage them and empower them, and then give them space to do what they need to do.
That's great.
Absolutely.
Isaiah, real quick, what gives you hope?
What gives me hope is that we have a generation that's coming up that's not going to take anything that's corrupt, that's not going to take any system that's trying to hold us down. What gives me hope is that we have a generation that's coming in to make effective change, and we're going to change this world in a positive manner.
And Jorge, what gives you hope?
What gives me hope is that this new generation that's coming up is kind of taking I wouldn't say the good path, but it's going, they want to change. They want new things. They want new, like Isaiah said, new policies, new laws. And what gives me hope is that a bunch of young folks are starting to get on that train to change that.
Sometime in the future, someone is going to go into a ballot box and they might check the name Isaiah Santiago for an important office. And they might need surgery, and it might be Dr. Jorge Jimenez who's presiding. Two remarkable people serving their communities already. Jorge, an honor to meet you on this program. I look forward to
the next conversation.
Thank you. Isaiah, same. Thank you for sharing your story with us today. And our thanks to Aaron Thompson, co-executive director of the MK Gandhi Institute for Nonviolence. Aaron, I look forward to the next conversation with you as well. Thank you.
Same here. Thank you, Evan.
From the whole team at Connections, thank you for listening. Hope you have a peaceful afternoon. We're back with you tomorrow on member-supported public radio.